We've had a lot of conversation between the sessions, and that's really exciting to me. Someone asked me this morning whether I've ever done a painting of what Holden means to me, and I said no, but whenever I'm at Holden, I do a lot of painting because that's what Holden means to me. And it means see and do and listen and share and all of those things. And so the process of painting is really what Holden means to me. I have never done a painting of that particular subject, and I never will. It's like all of you people sitting and talking. I think what Holden means to her is not almost as much the two flowers coming out of the rock as being able to tell the rest of us that that's where they are and we should go and see them. And so it's a special place because it makes us do some special things. Any other questions? Yes.
A question on
the Church. Yes. No, are you an engineer or something? Yeah. I worked for a number of years with a fellow by the name of Buckminster Fuller. I don't know how many of you are familiar with Bucky Fuller. And we did a number of things together, and that was one of the projects. We were trying, when the Bangladesh came into existence, we were trying very hard to devise living facilities for these people that would be economic, durable, movable, and would withstand varieties of temperature and weather. One of these experiments was the air platform, and it is a circulating air wall, very much like you have in some banks, large cities. You walk through and some grocery stores I know are having them now. You just walk right through a curtain of air. Well, if you govern the direction of the flow of the air, you are able to create a circulation that forces the whole wall to come to a peak at the top. It just attracts itself in a thing like cyclonic effect that eventually meets at a point. So it's a total enclosure of air. We built the platform, and we padded it so that noise would not be a big factor. The thing withstood a variety of different temperatures and climates. Falling leaves didn't come into into the space. It was really kind of interesting to watch it work. And I thought maybe we could experiment with it as a church, and it didn't work as a church. It was just purely a technological innovation. You don't go to church in order to look at the woods, and you don't go to church in order to admire your technology, in spite of what a lot of architects might suggest. So it was a problem. There was a number of other problems too. I couldn't figure out what to do with bathrooms. I mean, circulating air is all right, but you got to draw the line somewhere. And of course, I couldn't hang any paintings on the walls, but that was all right. And you had to have an extension cord for your little motors. And so there were things that didn't work with it, but it was an exciting thing to play around with. What we finally decided on doing was paper for the people of Bangladesh. And we designed, I don't know how many of you are familiar with foam core. foam core is styrofoam between two sheets of paper. And the paper is very slick, enamel-coated stuff. And you can crease the foam core and bend it then into any configuration you want. And so we played around with huge sheets of foam core and creasing and bending and folding, and wound up, after a few experiments, sending an airplane, one airplane, to Bangladesh with housing for 15,000 people. And they're just simply folded paper houses. And they tacked them down to wooden frames, and they withstood typhoons and lasted for about 5 years. And the total cost of housing for 15,000 people was $3,500. So, you know, it's all of that technology. That kind of technology makes a lot of people very nervous. It would be like developing an engine that got 300 miles to the gallon. That would make a lot of people very, very uncomfortable. And I'm sure that there would be Arabs that would pay dearly just to have that and stick it away somewhere, you know, forever and ever. And it's the same with these other kinds of technologies, that we are able to house 15,000 people in comfort for $3,500. You know, just really messes the bejeebers out of architects and engineers. It just really, you know. And we have, but there are all the other things that you have to do with a community of 15,000. Waste removal, disposal, drinking water, all of that. But you can spend your energy and your money then on food and those necessities if the shelter can be created for a minimal cost. And I guess I think that's the way the church ought to do it with its housing. And we want to talk about that this morning. Are there any other questions? Anything else? Okay. I guess that now that we have had some time together, I have, and probably deservedly so, earned the reputation of being the village clown. And I don't care. I probably am. I know I'm the only guy in the village that wears a dress. So, but I have to repeat, if I didn't say it before, I don't laugh with anything that I don't take incredibly serious. Everything that we're talking about is, in fact, sometimes I laugh in order to prevent tears from coming. Last night I just about lost it and had to say something funny just so that I wouldn't have to leave you and go to my room. So laughter for me is first one way to avoid getting overly emotional on the other side. But it's also a sign that I am very much involved with what I do. And it is not only a sign that what we are looking at that particular moment is foolish or ridiculous. I think of laughter in the Bible, and some of it is at its most tender, like Abraham and Sarah. And Abraham was told that he was going to have a son, Sarah was going to have a baby, and he says, "Well, you got to be kidding, she's all dried up. I mean, we can hardly, you know, move around together. You know, you just got to be out of your gourd." But they had one, and they named it Isaac, which means ha-ha. That's what, yeah, God's joke. God's joke. Ha ha, Isaac. Isn't that wonderful? And of course, you know what happened to ha ha and the sacrifice that it almost became, and it was a prefiguration of Christ and Jesus. And all of that is part of the foolishness of God's creation. So when I laugh, I am not making fun of things. I am really warming up to all of the problems and all of the celebrations that people have managed to create from the beginning of our faith life together until this very moment. Okay, one of the first questions that came as a result of last night's session on church architecture was, I was waiting, he said, all evening for you to show us something you liked. And you kept showing all those slides, and you didn't like any one of them. Are they doing anything that you happen to like? And I had to think, you know, I don't dislike those things. I think they represent a particular moment in a particular life of a particular congregation. Some of them I thought were a little sad or unnecessary. But yeah, a lot of things are being done that I like. Most of them are mine. I like some things that other people have done too. Just very few. Why don't we look at a couple of those? And I sure like looking at slides together in the morning better than I do in the evening, because I can still see your faces, and there's something about eye contact that helps in the delivery. The church, as it has experimented with different spaces for worship, has undergone rather drastic change. There is probably in every city in Europe at least one church that has an altar smack in the middle, because the liturgical renewal emphasized that we should gather around word and sacrament. So let's put the altar in the center and gather around. It only took one church, though, to find out how really frustrating that particular seating arrangement can be. Particularly if you are a preaching congregation, the pastor really can't do very much but stand on the altar and twirl like a top in order to get this eye contact that is so important. Very hard to preach from a point in the center with people gathered all around. The other thing which people didn't realize was that when you have an altar in the center and pews all around, that particular arrangement has more people farther from the altar than if you have a longitudinal floor plan, a regular old rectangle. Because, of course, the biggest pews are the farthest away. And you thought you had trouble people sitting in the back of the church in a rectangle. In a circle, that's where all the pews are, in the back. So, you didn't like the long one, and the round one doesn't work either, so what's the solution? The solution auf Deutsch is what they called Eier form, egg shape, elliptical, a point, the space getting fatter as it goes away from the altar and then coming back to a point. And what happens then is that people, if you pull the altar out a little way from that point, people can gather on three sides. That helps the preaching, that can help the choir, and the congregation is made more aware of itself as individuals. In most churches that are long and narrow, the thing you see the most as you sit there in the pew is hair. And hair is not really all that devotional. It does not call us to meditation, praise, and thanksgiving. And so what we want to do is gather in a way so that we are aware of the rest of us. But boy, the moving of that space to get people to looking at one another face to face is just fraught with all kinds of complications. I don't want them looking down my gullet while I'm singing, you know. Except, what are the jobs that we are supposed to do in worship? Admonish one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing with joy in your heart to the Lord. Boy, I'll tell you, when I was admonishing my kids, now they're all bigger than I am, I don't admonish them anymore. I got a high school kid who's 6'8", and I would you stop that? You know, not me, snap me like a twig. But I remember when they were of a size I could handle, and I was admonishing them, I did not want them to turn around. I did not want to see hair. I wanted to talk face to face. And that's the direction that the church is going, whether you like it or not. But I think that it is a much more human and interesting direction. And some of the processes by which we reach that direction are found in some of these early churches. I like this. This is in a village in Bavaria. So they got kind of villagey pews with little pegs so you can hang your hat or your child or whatever it is you want to hang on there. And the altar is pulled out away from the east wall. The early church only had two laws about the altar. One, it had to be at least a meter away from the back wall so that the fellow could get behind it and face the people. Ad populum. The other was absolutely no flowers. Now that, whenever I tell altar guilds that, they just, what else have we got to do now? We're not supposed to put flowers on the altar. Absolutely none. And this was for the early Christians who had to make a break between their ceremonies and those of Rome. And in Roman celebration, the height of the ceremony was when the Vestal Virgins came in and sopped up the blood of the sacrifices with bouquets of flowers. And so the relationship of flowers to the altar was of that pagan variety, and the early Christians didn't want to have anything to do with it, and so they got rid of it. Well, the altar is brought out. Kind of neat. I like the lighting fixtures that go in and come back out. It's almost they're assisting us in establishing a relationship with the altar. And the congregation gathers on that side under that arch over there. So they are facing it that way as well as this way. I like it. And I didn't do it. Some attempts at this are awfully heavy-handed. I don't know who gets to sit behind those pillars, but I sure wouldn't want to. And also that big air shaft, kind of light shaft, going up through the ceiling. The ceiling looks awful heavy to me, kind of like it should be an exhibition hall of some kind. But the idea of gathering around Word and Sacrament is very important in this design. Remember the church that I thought could use little horses going up and down around the outside? This is the inside, and it's really kind of nice. That ceiling is beautiful. The decking of wood that radiates from a circle that is right over the altar, and the congregation gathers around three sides. It's very nice. Why did they do that dumb thing on the outside? Because this is, if there is a thing that I think a church should convey, and it maybe not, it is not a religious word, but I think every church facility ought to convey, that is hospitality. That's a good Henry Nouwen word for those of you that read Henry. Hospitality, that you are welcome. Susan, this morning in Bible class was just absolutely delightful. When she talks about the disciples' response to Mary's announcement, they hid. They went up into their upper room and they locked the doors and they hid. And we have been hiding ever since. We build churches and we hide in them. And there is probably no different reason for us hiding away from the world in the things we build now than there was with the early disciples. We're afraid. Why? Who's going to come in there that we don't want? What have we got in there that we are not willing to give up? Well, folks, we got a lot in there that we're not willing to give up. And we have gotten so accustomed to a particular way of worship that to suggest any change in the paraphernalia even that we use will drive people away. You would not believe why people leave the church. People that have been devout Christians and Lutherans all their lives. Six families of a church in Minneapolis left because the pastor moved the altar 6 inches forward, 1 inch for every family. And they left. And the sad thing was, the pastor said, if that's all it takes to get them out of here, then they should probably go. And I said, if 6 inches of the altar will keep them here, then don't move the altar. What's more important, your stuff or their stuff? By the time the squabbling is over, it's just a matter of who won a fight over where to put a hunk of rock. And we all get into those skirmishes. Boy, I am renovating, I guess, about 16, 18 churches right now. And it is easier, I would rather start from scratch 10 churches than renovate one. Renovating is almost impossible. You know why? The little bronze plaques. Them little bronze suckers that got people's names on them that, you know, so-and-so in the memory of so-and-so gave such-and-such. And when it comes time to move those things, you realize they didn't give them at all. I mean, if they gave them, we should be able to move them. But they shall not be moved. I mean, I gave it and it won't be moved. Well, that doesn't make sense, folks. You didn't give it. You loaned it. And I have asked a number of building committees to start charging folks rent. Just to take, you know, to house the stuff that people have said, we gave it to you, and you can't move it. Well, if we're a storage thing for all this stuff, let's start getting a little money out of it. It is frightening. And people will give stuff. And they don't know why. People want to give to Aunt Maudie. Now, I'm sorry, you know, I am convinced that what I'm talking about is going to just offend the daylights out of some of you. I just have to cut a wide swath and hope for the best. But people will go to the building committee and say, Aunt Maudie died, we'd like to give something to the church. What should we give? And this poor committee starts looking all over the place for something because there's a gift coming. What do we need? And you know that down at the bottom of that list is like, let's do something for the transients in the community. Well, no. What Aunt Maudie wanted was something right up there up front. with a plaque. And usually what it winds up being is, you know, like, well, we've got a sanctuary lamp, but it's not very nice. Let's get a nicer sanctuary lamp. And they get a sanctuary lamp, and they don't have the vaguest idea what a sanctuary lamp is, or whether they need... Can you have a church, can you have Lutheran worship without a sanctuary lamp? Can ya? If you can, then ask Marty to give something else. Now, some people can't. Most of us, you know, we can. I mean, it took a while. You have to learn how to worship without a sanctuary lamp. But it means God is present. The presence of God. And so, as I said, our first session, you can drive by the church at 2 in the morning and you can look through the stained glass windows and see the sanctuary lamp on. And you know, she's in there. Which means you don't have to worry about bumping into her downtown. And we call it God's house, and we lock the door, and there is a light that says God is present. Come on, people, what's it mean? That is what it means. If you can invent a meaning for it, that's it. It can't mean anything else. Where two or three sanctuary lamps are gathered in my name, there am I in the midst. Folks, that's heresy. We make our objects as means of controlling God. And we lock the door and put our symbols in there. And it's no different from that Easter story we just heard about in Bible class. No different at all. I mean, some people are so afraid that light is going to go out that they've hooked it up to a wire, you know. I mean, the pastor was sick and tired of changing the candles all the time. It never got done, and he thought, oh, if that light goes out, what's that mean? So they just got them wired now. You know, in whoops we trust. That's right. Now, I am not anti-sanctuary lamp. Don't misunderstand. I like them in there as a sign of the presence of God. But on only one condition, that wherever else two or three of us are gathered, there is also a sanctuary lamp, like over our dining room table. Family altar, special light that says, our home is also sacred sanctuary worship place. And worship together in a big space is the gathering of all of the sacred places in the community, and they bring themselves together, and they bring their money, and they bring their bread, and they bring their wine. Most of us believe that liturgy is what the pastor keeps warm during the week for us, so that when we come on Sunday morning, it's already there waiting. That's wrong. Liturgy is what we bring. It's the service of the people. And most of us have built our churches so that they worship for us. They do our worshiping for us. Listen to people who have nice churches. Can I see your church? Sure, it's right down there on the corner. In other words, it isn't me. That's heresy, people. That is not the truth. The church is people, always. Okay. It is not stuff. It is not our collection. A choir. This church was designed for a choir. It was also designed for an orchestra. It really was, and it's a good idea. This is in Aachen, Germany, and this congregation has all of the members of the Aachen Philharmonic Symphony Orchestra. So every morning, I mean, eat your heart out, people. Every Sunday, they have a cantata by Pachelbel or Bach or, you know, isn't that awful? To know that there is that kind of creative juice in one congregation that allows them to have these big concerts for high mass every Sunday, it's a little bit strange. Every time they sit down on those kind of woven rush seats, there's like a great shoo. Every time you stand up, it's whoosh. So it's a little strange. But what a nice thing, having and looking straight at it. I mean, the congregation and the choir, they're all one thing, looking at each other and having a good time. I like it. So the gathering around has become more and more important. Not the facing. That's the problem if you've got a facility that you have built that worships for you, so that when you walk in, people can say, ooh, how religious. Or, ooh, how spiritual. Then what is your obligation in liturgy? To attend. Did you attend church this morning? Did you attend? The pastor at the end of the month has to fill out little forms. How many people attended? I somehow think it was in the education system that we got messed up there and got confused, assuming that just attendance was the same as participation. So we gave kids special buttons for perfect attendance. We didn't, you know, I mean, they could have been stupider at the end of the year than they were at the beginning, as long as they attended. And we got classes of 700 people at the university. And all we're supposed to do is drill a hole in the top of their heads and pour information down into there, and then about two or three times a semester, we ask them to spit it out about in the same way it went in. All we really want is their warm butts on the seat. That's called attendance. And very much of that idea is the same in worship, that you are just simply required to attend. We used to call the business of the church, you know, to match, hatch, and dispatch. Marriage, baptism, and funeral. Match, hatch, and dispatch. And you know why? You know a perfect sign in churches of that belief? These piddling, tiny little dinky narthexes. We get people into that neck of the bottle experience after the service, and they just go out into the parking lot. No time to get, if you want to have time for coffee and fellowship, you go over to the fellowship hall. You go down the steps, up the steps, somewhere over there, and we will have fellowship together. Well, come on, it's too much work. Let's face it. I'm just going to go home and have fellowship with my family. We'll kick off our shoes and we'll watch, you know, the Vikings. Or whatever. In other words, the church has simply asked for your warm butts on the pew. After that, go home. I mean, be sure you drop something in the collection plate, but after that, I will not build a new church unless the narthex is as big as the worship center, because it's in the narthex that you practice what we've been talking about the hour before. And if you cannot do that with people you have just confessed a common creed with, how in heaven's name do you go out into the community and do it with strangers? Well, the fact of the matter is, you don't. You went to church and it was like going to the ballet or going to a flick. You just sat there, and if the preacher was 15 minutes, you said amen. If it was 20 minutes, you said hmm. And if it was 25 minutes, you asked whether there was another church of the similar persuasion elsewhere in the community. That's right. That's right. The preacher has got to entertain you. The songs, the choir, everything has got to make you feel good. But worship is not feeling good, people. Worship is work. And it is hard, hard work. I do not believe it is a worthwhile service unless you come out of it tired. I mean, like you have really been to work. It is not time out so we can see and hear some things that make us forget our daily cares. It is bringing your daily cares to the altar. It is, like Susan said this morning, time for forgiveness. Time for loosening each other from the things that were tying us down. Time to learn what the pastor is supposed to be teaching us to do, not whom we have paid to do it all for us. Because as Luther says, there is nothing that the pastor does in worship that we are not doing with and for each other. And that's work, people. So the space is now a space for work. This is Holy Cross Day. Here is a Holy Cross. A little church in Mishawaka. No pew is more than 7 away from the altar. Whew. The cross is as long as it is up. You know what else is as long as it is up? Us. We are as long as we are high, each of us. And so the cross takes on a kind of human shape. And you don't stand there and admire the artwork. They got little stained glass things in this church. They're in the back. So you walk out under the stained glass. You don't stare at it. And what's the stained glass of? Mishawaka. The stained glass is a map of Mishawaka with the St. Joe River running through it, and factories and houses and stores and shops. This is one of 2 windows. So they walk under Mishawaka. As though to say, when you are leaving, you are now entering your mission field, or as we have carved over the doorways, the last thing people see when they walk out, servant's entrance. A little church in Livonia, Michigan. The altar is in the middle, but it's in the middle of a square, and the square is sideways so that you enter. It's like a baseball diamond, okay? And you enter at home plate. All right? You enter at home plate, and that's the baptismal font. I kind of like the baptismal font at home plate. And the altar is on the pitcher's mound, and the pulpit is on second base. Okay, and now you run the pews that way, and as they go back to third base and first base, they get smaller and smaller and smaller. Half of this congregation sits in the first pew. <laughs> 65 people in the first pew, 6, 3 on each side in the last pew. If you want to sit in the back, you got to get there really early. But it's all in the round. Nice thing about this is about 10 years old, maybe 12. And this church, this congregation built this church. The stone came out of their own property. They had 7 acres, built the whole thing, including a big fellowship hall, an organ, all the furnishings, everything, a completely equipped kitchen, $138,000 on 7 acres of Livonia property, that included. So it's possible, you know, more worship places have been ruined with too much money than have been ruined by not enough. Okay. Whoever designed this had it cloned and dropped it all over Christendom. I don't know how many of you have a church. How many of you have churches like this or have worshipped in it? Okay. It is, you can tell what the fetish was in most Lutheran churches. It was symmetry. Symmetry. You had to have everything symmetrical. The interesting thing is that means that the only way the design makes any sense is if you're standing in the aisle and you're not supposed to. Would you kindly have a seat? And well, as soon as you have a seat, everything's out of symmetry again. So why you bother with a thing on each side? I mean, look at this. Three is a perfectly good number for a flower arrangement. But if you have to have symmetry, you wind up with 6, which is not a very good number. That's how we got a church flag to balance the American flag. So now we got 2 flags. That's how we have a lectern. We have this lectern over here because if we just had a pulpit without one, the whole church would just sort of flip over, you know, on its side. The weight, the sheer weight would just cause the whole thing to flip over. I am working with a church down in Oregon that remodeled their church 3 times. And what they did, they had a facility like this and they just added to here, and then the 3rd time they added more. They have 55 rows of pews, 5 people on each side. I mean, the whole wedding procession has to be played 3 times just to get the bride all the way down. When you stand out in the narthex waiting to go, it almost looks like you can't get down the center aisle without going sideways. It is so long and narrow. And everything plastered up against that end wall. 2 hymn boards. And then the choir, God bless them, they sit over here and they sing to the stained glass windows. Back and forth they sing. And nobody else gets benefit of that. Well, to give you just an idea of how we change some things like that, this is how it is now. This took 2 years of just talking before we got them to the point of moving the whole thing forward and putting congregation and or choir in the chancel after lowering it all down to the same floor level, rising the chancel up 1 7-inch step and filling over in here either choir or congregation depending upon the service, and that of course meant fewer people in these rows here. So it seats the same, but it's a gathering around instead of a facing towards like you might do in a theater. Another one looks like the same church. It's another church. It's a little bigger. This red. This is ecclesiastical red carpet. That's one Lutheran pastor said it had to be red because it represented the blood of Christ. And I couldn't believe. You know, I mean, you're walking down the aisle on the blood of Christ. I don't know, is that a familiar thing to you? That's the first time I ever heard of the carpet being turned into a symbol. Acrolan blood. This is really bad. Well, here we got the symmetry again. You know, we got 2 candelabra. You wouldn't want 1 candelabra. That would look too Jewish. And so you got 2 candelabra. Well, 7 is a perfectly good number, but, you know, our whole number thing ends with 12. It really doesn't. I mean, but Green Grow the Rushes Ho stops at 12. So we've got 12 for the 12 apostles, 11 for the 11 who went to heaven, and 10 for the 10 commandments, 9 for the 9 bright shiners, 8 for the April rainers, 7 for the 7 stars in the sky, and 6 for the 6 proud walkers, 5 for the symbols at your door, and 4 for the gospel makers, 3 the rivals, 2 the lily white boys, clothed all in green hoe, 1 is one and all alone, and evermore shall be so. You got all the symbols up to 12. And that 7 is in there somewhere, but you got symmetry, and that gives you 14, and 14 isn't on our list. So it's only up there for symmetry's sake. We got a big lectern to keep the pulpit, you know, balanced off. We got the choir back there. Boy, look at that. The choir is back in that hole, with one of these little creepy peepy mirrors up there to make sure that the choir doesn't abscond with any of the music after service. We got a speaker system here coming straight out, two hymn boards. We also got speaker systems inside facing each other. Now that's an interesting thing. Can you imagine the pastor standing at the altar, which you probably wouldn't have noticed unless it had been draped, and listening to the speaker system sounding back and forth over his head? Well, it took 4 years of talking with the congregation before we came up with that. That's the same church. Want to go back? From that to that. And that specifically spells out a direction of participation rather than attendance. That's the idea of what we do with those spaces. And really, it's a cleaning up. It's a cleaning up process. Almost all renovation is cleaning up. And the first question that comes when you want to clean up is, what's wrong with the way it is? And it is not a matter of wrong. It's a matter of next. Next. And you should be able to affirm, if you laugh, you know, what they did and how they built. Now let's get on. Give us something to do too. I don't like churches that are built for our children and our children's children. Let them build their own. We got some special problems. We want to solve them now. Give us a space where we can solve our problems, and maybe they can dismantle it and put something in that's more relevant to them and their time. Who knows? Maybe the church in their time will have to be a hospital. Have we got a space that would easily convert into a hospital? We've done them. I don't like this. I did it and it's bad. I had to make some exchanges with them. I didn't want a permanent step. I wanted platforms that they could move, but they wanted them permanent. So in exchange, I got their ecclesiastical red carpet, you know. Oh, yeah, go back and forth and you dicker. They shouldn't have those candles on the altar. You shouldn't have that cross on the altar. The pastor can't get back there and look at the people. What's he going to, you know? You can't do it. So why bother having an altar out in the middle in the first place? So, funny business. Here is a church in which the platform moves. Everything moves. Stacked boxes. Beautifully made, with handles in the side. They can have 3 levels, 2 levels, 1 level, no level. Here we are set up for the short pastor. When the tall pastor comes, we put the box in and raise the pulpit. Huh? It's no biggie. We got some problem thinking that what happens in worship is sort of booga booga, you know. And as a result, we won't behave like we would normally. That's why I think hospitality is the most important thing. Well, there are no railings up here. I remember talking to the congregation. I said, I don't think it's wrong to kneel. I don't think it's wrong to stand. What would happen if you had some people kneeling and some people standing? No problem. Why can't you do that? Does it have to be, you know, push, pull, click, click, stick it in there, going down the line? What's your big rush? How about spending a little time talking with the children up there? I remember given distributing communion and calling some, you know, the body of Christ given for you, Harriet. And she practically lost it right there on the... I forgot. I'm Harriet. We try and be nameless in there. So when I proposed, you know, one lady said, hey, I got arthritic knees. You're not going to give me a rail? I want to kneel. You're not going to give me a rail? How am I going to kneel? And the president of this congregation, who was, you know, about 6'5 and weighed 250 pounds, said, no, yeah, how's she going to kneel? I said, help her, you big lummox. You know, what are we standing around with people who can't manipulate so well, and we just sit back there in the pew and say, hey, he's okay, we got a rail. And people who are in dire straits, that if they were total strangers on the street, you would go up and be of assistance. In church, you sort of stand around and scratch your head, wondering, are they going to make it or not? It's absolutely ridiculous. We are a body in here, people. We help each other. If somebody is hurting, we hurt. And when we hurt, we go for first aid. And that is us. That's us. We help each other get up and down. Now, you know, some people, you know, that look like they need help, you know, don't want it. I mean, I have tried to help some people that would just, you know, hey, will you go away? Leave me alone. I can get down there. And then afterwards, we go out to the narthex and talk about it. I didn't realize you were in such good shape. You know, and we have coffee together, and we live under each other's and with each other's foolishness and forgiveness. That's right. We let each other loose, like Susan said this morning. And the baptismal font is eight-sided because eight, you know, seven is the complete number. Seven vices, seven virtues, seven notes in the Gregorian scale, 7 days in the week. It's the number of completeness. It's our number because we are earth. You know, the banner in the back, four corners, that's the number four is the number of earth. Three is the number of spirit, and so we are body and soul. Three and four, seven is our number. And therefore, eight is the number of starting over. You must be born again. The banner on the wall? Yeah. I liked it for the time it was there. Those things are to come and go. They change. You know, one of the problems we have with banners is that somebody works awful hard, puts it up there, and we can't talk them into taking it down. As a result, you walk into a lot of churches, and you got the whole church year up there because nobody wants to take their banner down. I worked hard on that banner. Leave it up. You mean one Sunday? You got to be crazy. No, you put it up and you take it down. My goodness, the pastor works hard on the sermon. You want him to preach the same thing four Sundays running? You demand that it be different every Sunday. It's the same way with our creativity. You move it in and you take it out. You celebrate its moving. Not just its coming, but its going. And boy, some goings I celebrate really quite a lot. I'm really glad they're going, you know. There is a congregation in New Orleans that makes a banner and does its own bulletins for every service. Every service. They meet together on Thursday night as a congregation and they do text study. There are very few congregations that have events for families. I am convinced that the church is probably the most divisive element in our social structure. They don't do stuff for all of us together. Families get split up Men go somewhere on Tuesdays, women on Thursdays, children, depending upon their ages, go at different times. And on Sunday morning, we all scatter. The choir is all by itself. Pooey, let them sit with their families. Let it be the gathering of families. One, let it be the gathering of one, and two, and four. But whatever the living unit is during the week, let it be celebrated within the congregation. Instead of having the church design split us up. And so this little congregation gathers with all of its people, and it makes a banner and a bulletin. First comes the bulletin. New artist every week. And who is it? A child. That's probably the most neglected creative source in the congregation. Every child is a born artistic genius until they get to the fourth grade, by which time they have been de-geniused. But they start out okay, so if you get them early enough, they'll make your bulletin covers. And then you take the bulletin cover design and you blow it up. Or blow part of it up and make a banner out of a section so that the bulletin and the banner are together. And you learn about the music that's going to be sung the next. So the congregation is prepared to celebrate, not just to attend. And of course, in that particular congregation, the usher is the artist. It takes a little longer getting into church because the kid is holding up the bulletin, you know. Mine. I know it says Harry, my name, all the way across it. I just wanted to let you know I did it. And welcome to church, and here is the bulletin, which I did on Thursday night. And if you notice, the banner is also taken from my artwork, which I did on Thursday during text study. Well, it takes a little while, you know, to get people into church with an usher like that. But boy, are you affirming the kids. Affirming the children. And not just so they can come back to church next Sunday, but because of what they are. Uh-oh. Skip that. There is a font, an altar, and a pulpit here. The font looks a little bit like what you spit in a dentist's office. The altars come in all different shapes and forms. The general direction is to have them assume more of a table shape instead of a sarcophagal shape. Now that is a wonderful piece of art. That is bronze. Weighs many tons. What do they do for Easter? A little altar with nine legs. Beautiful little thing. Very simple. A big altar, but it's movable. You have to want to move it, but it's movable. For a lumbering community, tore a tree out by the roots and built an altar over the stump. Somehow, even in the making of a table, you affirm the community and the uniqueness of that congregation. Fonts are probably one of the more silly inventions. I mean, we tend to make them that. You're not baptized in a font. You're baptized in water. But when you walk into most churches, you know, it's the font. One of the reasons is, like Lutherans. Lutherans are pro-lid. Have you ever noticed that? We're big on lids. You can walk into a, you know, and there's no water. You take two guys, you know, give them a hernia, just lifting that lid off and have it clang on the floor. If you look underneath there, there's probably a little spun aluminum ashtray with a dead fly in it or cobwebs or very dusty. And that's supposed to be your sign of baptism, a font. It isn't. It's water. You got no water, you got no sign of baptism. So that'll do it without too much anxiety about getting too personal. Son Stephen was baptized with water from the drinking fountain of the second floor of Porter Memorial Hospital in Valpo, poured into a Dixie cup the day before he died. and I am going to dance with that little guy in heaven someday. Not because of the Dixie cup, but because of water, word, and promise. But we will invent. Ooh, boy, do we invent. This is Brumhilda's font. Oh, you design a container for water and then you carve water all over it and then don't put any in. Now that's a little silly. You're carving water out of granite. Wouldn't it just be easier to go to the faucet and get water and put it in there? I have done stained glass water, granite water, marble water, wood water for people that are afraid to put water into the font. It's ridiculous. See, that's what you can do then with extra lids. You can turn them upside down and make more fonts. How about this one, folks? You pull down on the bird and the lid goes up. This was in a Catholic church in Germany. A Lutheran pastor in Chattanooga wanted to do one of these for his church. He asked me whether I thought it was a good thing for a Lutheran church, and I said, nope. We don't have that much pull with the Holy Spirit. But hey, would you stick your baby under there? I mean, I am going to get an EKG report on the guy who's holding that bird. You know, if he lets go, we are down the tubes. This is real. I mean, just sticking the kid under is an act of faith. If he survives, he's a new creature. Oh, our ingenuity gets in the way of grace. It's water. It's so simple. It's so simple. We just really want to jazz it up. A sign of Jonah. I like it. An octagon, Greek cross, sides connected. Oh, there's a porcelain bowl. 2 feet across. Now, that, I don't know how many of you are ceramic people, but porcelain is a tough thing to work with, and it took a long time, and then it was glazed. And I took it to the pastor down in Portland, the church right there on the Columbia River, and he looks into the bowl, and he says, it's got some cracks in there, Rich. And I said, oh, well, you know, it's just in the glaze, Paul, that's okay. It's not, I mean, the water is going to stay in there. And he said, are you sure? Well, we pour water in. We hold it over our head. See, there's nothing coming through, Paul. Yeah, he says, but people are going to look down into that, and they're going to say, there are cracks in the bottom of the bowl. I said, well, talk to him about that. It's the glaze. Oh, well, hey, you can't interrupt the middle of a baptism service. Some lady's holding her baby over there and says, there are cracks down at the bottom of the bowl. When am I supposed to explain when those cracks, that everything's okay? Well, I don't want to argue with people. I'm trying to figure out desperately how we can cover the cracks. And so we went down to the river, and we got a little water-washed pebble for every baptized member of the congregation and put pebbles in the bottom of the bowl. And during the baptism service, there is written into their baptismal liturgy the dropping of the pebble. This is the design of liturgy to cover the cracks. A whole new theology we've come up with. And it works. It works. And it added a dimension which tied them to the river that flowed by. Which ties them, I mean, their pebble is down there with all of the other pebbles, so there's that body language in the act of baptism. And the little baby gets a chasuble because the baby is a new priest in the congregation, buried with Christ by baptism unto death and raised again to new life in the Holy Spirit. And the pastor lifts it up and takes it around to introduce it to the members of the congregation. Pulpits I have known and loved. Hey, Grundtvig Church, Copenhagen, brick pulpit. Boy, would you feel like Herr Pastor in that one. When I first did this, one of the pastors said, "But Rich, how am I going to scratch?" And it was then that I realized what the pulpit was really for. The pulpit is not a symbol of the word. If for you the word is little w word and that means Bible, then the book is symbol of word. If it's big W word, it's people speaking the good news to one another. The pulpit is a piece of furniture, pure and simple. So if you don't need it, make sure you're able to get it out of there. I guess my favorite pulpit is this. Boy, don't you just want to hear one of them sermons. If you're going to do glass, have it come in from the side, not straight ahead, so that it becomes a wall and it warms you from the side. This is a window that we built out of the broken glass of a bombed-out church in Germany. Pieced all the glass together and put it back in. It's not something that you look into. You couldn't possibly and still worship. It's something that warms you from the side. But here's one that I did for a cathedral in France, where they make crystal in Baccarat. And so we decided to make the windows out of crystal, which is very pure. And about 3 weeks after dedicating this, the bishop calls me. I was back in the States, and he says, "You get over here now." And I got onto the Concorde and flew to Paris and took the train down to Baccarat. And he, his grace, met me at the depot and without a word ushers me to the cathedral and to the narthex. I mean, and to the sacristy. And there he gets out his vestment of last Sunday and puts it on and raises his hands. And he got a hole in the neighborhood of the belly button. My window set him on fire. Whoa, my, I say, your grace, if we could have just designed this for Pentecost, whoa, would that have been... He was not amused. And so I had to go to the cemetery director and get a little sandblaster and sandblast some of that crystal so that the sun would not come in quite so pure. You get creative people together and you never know what is going to catch fire. But the idea of our life together is somehow we catch fire. That we catch fire during the week. Not just for a time that we call worship, but that when you attend your children, that is a worship time. When you sit around the family table, that is worship time. When you wake up in the morning and your feet first touch the floor, that is worship time. When you go to bed and your head first touches the pillow, that is worship time. And on Sunday, all of the gifts of all of the people in that special place come together and we celebrate with laughter, with water, with word and wheat, and with fire. It's the only way that makes any sense. God bless.